Richard Martin's Wake Up Call podcast, presented every Monday and Friday, providing you with the truth and the facts. You decide.
Hello again, everyone. This is Richard Martin with your Wake Up Call on Monday, October the 5th, 2015, and I'm coming to you, as always, from Penang. And by the way, before I forget, here's my phone number in case any of you are trying to get in touch. It's a US number, and it's at area code 305-454-2707. That's once again 305-454-2707. Okay, so some of you may have heard about a company called Glencore, and I'm going to start today by talking about this company and the very ugly situation we're looking at dead ahead. We may well be about to witness the most important global financial event since the collapse of Lehman Brothers in 2008. Glencore has been known as the largest commodities trading company on the entire planet, and at one time it was ranked as the 10th biggest company in the world. It is linked to trillions of dollars of derivatives trades globally, and if the firm were to implode, it would be a financial disaster unlike anything that we have seen in Europe since the end of World War II. Well, now it seems that all signs are pointing to an inescapable death spiral for Glencore. The stock price was down nearly 30% last Monday, and overall, Glencore stock has plunged nearly 80% since May. There are certainly other candidates for the next Lehman, Petrobras and Deutsche Bank being two perfect examples, but Glencore has definitely surged to the front of the pack. Right now, many analysts are openly wondering if the firm will even be able to survive to the end of next month. If you are not familiar with Glencore, the following is a pretty good summary of the commodity trading giant from Wikipedia, and I quote, "Glencore PLC is an Anglo-Swiss multinational commodity trading and mining company headquartered in Baar, Switzerland, with its registered office in St. Helier, Jersey. The company was created through a merger of Glencore with Xstrata on the 2nd of May 2013. As of 2014, it ranked 10th in the Fortune Global 500 list of the world's largest companies. It is the world's third largest family business. As Glencore International, the company was already one of the world's leading integrated producers and marketers of commodities. It was the largest company in Switzerland and the world's largest commodities trading company, with a 2010 global market share of 60% in the internationally tradable zinc market, 50% in the internationally tradable copper market, 9% in the internationally tradable grain market, and 3% in the internationally tradable oil market." End of quote. Well, I've been warning, as you know, for months about the consequences of the crash that we have been witnessing in commodity prices. We saw a similar thing happen in 2008, just before the financial crisis that erupted in the fall of that year. If commodity prices kept going down, which they did, it was only a matter of time before firms like Glencore started imploding. At this point, Glencore owes almost twice as much money as the entire firm is worth. Now, there is every chance that the merged operation could implode. If it does, it will be the resources sector's very own Lehman Brothers moment. With debt approaching $30 billion and a market value of just $16 billion, Shareholders and those holding the debt are desperately looking for an exit. The cost of Glencore's credit default swaps, financial instruments that insure against a default, soared overnight. Actually, soared is an understatement. The cost of insuring Glencore's debt is absolutely screaming into the stratosphere. This is precisely what we would expect to see right before a Lehman Brothers moment. So here are some of the specific details from the Wall Street Journal, and I quote, "Investors had to pay on Monday more than $790,000 a year to insure $10 million of Glencore debt against default for 5 years using credit default swaps, according to Market, more than 40% higher than the preceding Friday. At the beginning of the year, the same insurance cost $154,000. End of quote. When Glencore does go down, they'll take a whole lot of others with them, because Glencore's tied to trillions of dollars worth of derivatives trades across the planet. According to Zero Hedge, we are, quote unquote, looking at the start of a self-fulfilling prophecy which leads to the company's IG downgrade and the collapse of trillions in derivative notionals as what may be the trading desk of the biggest commodity counterparty quietly goes out of business." End of quote. Well, as all of you know who've been following me for any length of time, I've been ranting for years about the danger of derivatives. I warn incessantly that they will play a starring role in the next financial crisis. Now the reality of this is staring us in the face. The "nothing is happening" crowd is completely and utterly clueless. There are these people running around telling everyone that the stock market decline is over and that we aren't about to experience another great financial crisis. You know, I don't understand how these people can be so ignorant. Global giants such as Glencore, Petrobras, and Deutsche Bank are imploding right in front of our eyes. But the Pollyanna crowd will continue to tell you that nothing is happening, even in the face of undeniable evidence to the contrary. And the sad thing is that many of these mockers are given airtime on the big mainstream news networks. They will tell you that stocks are oversold and that you should buy the dip because stocks are going to be going back to record highs really soon. The reality is that we're finally witnessing the bursting of the last great global financial bubble. Here's how Bill Holter put it recently. Quote, "In my opinion, we are already well within the jaws of a meltdown shutdown as liquidity is evaporating. There are a dozen developed countries with their stock markets already in bear markets. That's down 20% or more. All crashes come from oversold levels, just as bank runs come on fast and are a surprise at the time. What is coming should be no surprise to anyone, as we're looking at the end of not only an empire, but of a flawed system which has endured for far too many years. This was a solvency problem in 2008, and liquidity was the incorrect tool used then. Now, it is a bigger solvency problem with an illiquidity kicker attached, while the Fed has already used every tool imaginable and every last ounce of credibility. The loss of confidence in the issuer of the world's reserve currency would be bad enough in an unlevered world. The loss of confidence in today's debt world will be a disaster. To wrap this up, do not let anything that may happen from here surprise you. The conditions are ripe for global currency crises and a shutdown of credit. The conditions are also ripe for hot war to explode in multiple venues. A meltdown or shutdown of markets will serve as a final flush of what remains left of the middle class. End of quote. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are steamrolling towards a global economic collapse that will be permanent and irreversible. There are way too many people out there that think they know it all and that have a tremendous amount of blind faith in the system. Now the system is failing, and that blind faith is about to be shattered. Well, while we're on the subject of commodities, copper prices fell to $4,920 a ton a week ago, before recovering slightly. The price has been crashing and is down 21% so far in 2015, after falling 16% in 2014. The current price is at a six-year low, just above the low of the financial crisis 6 years ago. The crash is expected to continue, with predicted prices at $4,800 at the end of this year and $4,500 at the end of next year. Just as the 60% collapse in the price of oil has been disastrous for exporting countries around the world, including Russia, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Venezuela, the collapse in the price of copper is rippling throughout the world. The copper crash is being mostly blamed on the slowdown in China's economy, which is also causing drops in prices of coal, oil, and metals. The copper crash is causing crashes in the prices of stocks for mining companies. Miners are some of the largest companies in the world, responsible for hundreds of thousands of jobs in many countries. The world's largest miner is Melbourne-based BHP Billiton, whose stock price has fallen 29% in the last 3 months. The second largest miner, also Melbourne-based, is Rio Tinto, which is less dependent on copper, has limited its stock declines this year to 30%. And then, of course, there's our friend Glencore, the world's third largest copper miner, which fell 30% last Monday alone. The result is a disaster for the African country Zambia, whose economy is heavily dependent on the price of copper. Glencore has announced plans to suspend operations in the country, which will result in the loss of thousands of jobs. Zambia's currency, the kwacha, fell 13% against the dollar last Monday. Glencore is also suspending operations in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Stock prices for another copper mining company, Phoenix AZ-based Freeport-McMoRan Inc., fell over 10% on Monday, with the stock price now down 61% since the beginning of the year. Freeport announced earlier this month that it's cutting in half its operations in Chile and will be laying off hundreds of workers. As I've been saying for many years, the world is in a deflationary spiral in this generational crisis era. Deflation has gripped economies in Europe, America, China, and Japan. The deflationary spiral is affecting global stock prices, which fell to a two-year low on Tuesday, at the end of the worst quarter in years. Well, there are very few people who lived through the 1929-1946 Depression. The passing of older generations is a key component in the recurring cycles which propel the world through the seemingly chaotic episodes that paint portraits on the canvas of history. The current alignment of generations is driving this crisis and will continue to give impetus to its future direction. The alignment is always the same. Old artists, the silent generation, die. Prophets, the baby boomers, enter elderhood. Nomads, Generation X, enter midlife. Heroes, millennials, enter young adulthood. And a new generation of child artists, Generation Y, is born. This is the part of the cycle in which America's institutional life is torn down and rebuilt from the ground up, always in response to a perceived threat to the nation's very survival. Neil Howe anticipates the climax of this crisis arriving in the 2022 to 2025 time frame, with the final resolution happening between 2026 and 2029. Any acceleration in these timeframes would likely be catastrophic, bloody, and possibly tragic for mankind. As presented by Strauss and Howe, this crisis will continue to be driven by the core elements of debt, civic decay, and global disorder, with the volcanic eruption travelling along channels of distress and aggravating problems ignored, neglected, or denied for the last 30 years. Let's examine the channels of distress which will surely sway the direction of this crisis. Despite incessant corporate fascist propaganda disguised as positive government economic data, the economic distress for the majority of Americans and the majority of the world will be soul-crushing. Ignore any happy talk about a recovering economy and return to normality. We are dealing with a crisis-level economic condition. The financial stress on average American families is already at punishing levels, masked by the prodigious amount of debt doled out by the government and their Wall Street co-conspirators. Millennials are buried under $1.3 trillion of student loan debt, with $500 billion of it doled out by the federal government since 2009 as a ploy to reduce the reported unemployment rate and artificially stimulate spending to provide the appearance of economic recovery. The myth of the supposed recovery is borne out in a labour participation rate that is the lowest since 1977. With participation amongst 25 to 54-year-olds the lowest in history. With real median household incomes stuck at 1989 levels and far below 2007 peak levels, the stress on middle-class families just to pay their monthly bills is intense. The 2008 Wall Street-created fraudulent subprime mortgage debacle led to millions of foreclosures. It was also responsible for non-existent wage growth, young families enslaved in student loan debt, and the Wall Street hedge funds, which engineered a 30% increase in home prices. This debacle has resulted in home ownership falling to historic lows, and it's still falling. This is the result of ownership policies, programs and schemes pushed by Democrat and Republican politicians and executed by greedy Wall Street institutions, generating hundreds of billions in fees, interest and profits. Clearly, there is no distress among the 0.1% as they summer at their Hamptons Beach estates, gorging on caviar and toasting their financial brilliance, courtesy of free Fed money, with $1,000 bottles of Dom Pérignon. In their spare time, they bid New York City penthouse real estate prices to astronomical levels. But as the government apparatchiks at the Bureau of Labour Statistics, the BEA and Census Bureau have reported positive economic data month after month since 2009, the number of people on food stamps has grown from 34 million to 46 million over this same time frame. As the middle class and poor have gotten poorer, the 0.1%, and particularly the 0.01%, have accelerated their capture of the national wealth. The distress of the lower classes is self-evident and confirmed by a poverty rate of 14.8%, up from 12.5% in 2007. While the middle class has borne the brunt of an Obamacare plan written and paid lobbyists for the health insurance industry, big pharma and hospital corporations. The promised $2,500 per family savings have not materialized. This is because health insurance premiums have increased by double digits for the last 5 years, and small businesses have stopped covering employees. In reality, since 2008, average family premiums have climbed a total of $4,865. Even the few million Americans added to the health insurance rolls are stuck with limited choices and deductibles of $5,000. More people were kicked out of existing employer healthcare plans than were newly added. You only have to look at two charts which reveal the true level of economic distress. They are the federal debt and money printing charts. I've posted them both on the email distribution circuit several times recently. America has accumulated more debt as a nation in the last 7 years, to the tune of $8 trillion, than it did in the first 219 years of the once proud republic. The country continues to add $1.6 billion a day to its $18.3 trillion national debt. This doesn't even take into consideration the $200 trillion of unfunded liabilities being left to future generations. The Fed has printed $3.5 trillion out of thin air in the last 6 years, while keeping interest rates anchored at 0% for their Wall Street owners, with the net impact of punishing senior citizens and other risk-averse savers, while further enriching their gambling casino owners who dictate the monetary policy for the world. As widowed grandmothers across the land have seen their life-sustaining interest income evaporate, even the downwardly manipulated CPI has risen 14% since 2008. Using a real inflation measure, most Americans have seen their daily living expenses rise by more than 30% since 2008. But Yellen and her cronies keep on yammering on about deflationary fears. Economic distress intensifies by the day for average American households, as real income has been falling for 15 years, while the cost of food, energy, healthcare fees and tolls has risen exponentially over this time frame as the parasite sucks the host dry. Millions of households have been lured into debt by the Wall Street debt machine and their corporate media mouthpieces, as consumer debt has grown from $1.5 to $3.4 trillion since the year 2000, and mortgage debt has grown from $6.5 to $13.5 trillion. The extreme distress felt by households has been caused by their foolish choice to try and maintain their lifestyles by replacing declining income with debt. They are now enslaved by the chains of $1.3 trillion in student loan debt, $1.1 trillion of auto loan debt, $1 trillion of credit card debt, and $13.5 trillion of mortgage loan debt. I very much doubt that keeping up with the Joneses has been worth it. The stress of meeting the monthly payment obligations with declining income has become unbearable for many. The continued decline in real household income reveals the nonsense of the unemployment propaganda disguised as legitimate data. The decline in unemployment from 10% in 2009 to 5.1% today is a complete and utter lie. Since 2008, there are 4 million more Americans employed, while 15 million working-age Americans have supposedly left the workforce, but the government expects us to believe the unemployment rate is lower today than it was in 2008. Using a consistent labour force participation rate of 66%, where it stayed from 2003 through 2008, the unemployment rate would be over 10%. Using the Bureau of Labor Statistics methodology used prior to 1994, real unemployment exceeds 20%. Those figures support the declining household income story. Everyone has heard the president boast about the 10 million jobs added since 2009. The politicians like to talk about quantity, but aren't so keen on discussing quality. You can see for yourself the facts regarding jobs added since the recession lows. The top four categories pay less than $10 an hour. This so-called economic recovery is being driven by low-paying, no-benefits service jobs. These facts also support the declining household income state of affairs. With a true unemployment rate above 10% and most new jobs paying $10 an hour, it's understandable to an awake, non-delusional citizen why retail sales remain pathetic and national retailers have stopped expanding and begun closing outlets. This is just what the corporate fascist deep state wants. They want the proletariat, reliant upon debt, to sustain their materialistic-driven lifestyles, and the lower-class peasants, dependent upon the scraps handed to them by a government, reliant on central bankers to keep the House of Cards from collapsing. The American economy has been gutted. The financialization of the economy began around 1980 and accelerated after the passage of NAFTA in 1994 and the repeal of Glass-Steagall in 1999. There has been a giant sucking sound of manufacturing jobs leaving the US, replaced by purveyors of paper, derivatives gamblers, and high-frequency traders on Wall Street. Producing goods has been replaced by scamming muppets and peddling debt to the masses so they can consume. America's been eating its seed corn for the last 35 years, and there's nothing left to sow. America allowed its jobs and production to be replaced by cheap foreign labor and cheap foreign-produced products, financed by consumer debt. The country allowed mega corporations and Wall Street banks to capture the economic system, financial markets, judicial, legislative, and executive branches, along with the mainstream media, thereby subjugating the best interests of the country to maximizing profits for the 0.1%. The distress of the working middle class has been growing since the early 1970s, after Nixon closed the gold window and allowed central bankers and politicians the freedom to print fiat and make unfunded promises to voters. From the end of World War II until 1971, the working class reaped the income gains as their standard of living steadily increased. Since 1971, the income growth of the working class has declined, while the income growth of the top 1% has soared. This was mainly driven by the 0.1% in the financial class, who produced nothing but misery for the bottom 90%. Unbridled greed and an unquenchable thirst for more and more are the hallmarks of the sociopathic oligarchs, who are like blood-sucking leeches on the dying carcass of a once great nation. Once the dollar was no longer backed by gold, the ultimate death of the American empire became a foregone conclusion. The weight of lies is wearing on the oligarchs. The Federal Reserve chairwoman physically falters while spreading monetary falsehoods, and the Speaker of the House suddenly resigns as he knows the end is drawing near. Every so-called solution the ruling class has implemented since Wall Street blew up and the global financial system in 2008 has been sold to the public as beneficial to the people on Main Street. It has slowly dawned on the inhabitants of Main Street that Bernanke, Yellen, Paulson, Geithner, Dodd, Frank, Obama, and all DC politicians have screwed them. As Main Street's distress has accelerated, the wealth of anyone associated with Wall Street has soared to obscene levels. This distress is revealing itself in the poll numbers of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. The flaunting of their immense wealth, political influence, and smug superiority has angered a vast swath of the citizenry. The economic distress perpetrated upon the people by the moneyed interests will be the driving force behind the next phase of the crisis. The current state of affairs was seen before, during the previous Semilla crisis, about 80 years ago. What John Steinbeck had to say in Canner Row seems fitting here, and I quote, "It has always seemed strange to me. The things we admire in men, kindness and generosity, openness, honesty, understanding and feeling, are the concomitants of failure in our system. And those traits we detest, sharpness, greed, acquisitiveness, meanness, egotism and self-interest, are the traits of success. And while men admire the quality of the first, they love the produce of the second." End of quote. The solution is not to let politicians redistribute the wealth from the rich to the poor. Crony capitalism must be replaced by true free market capitalism, practiced with integrity, fairness, principled conduct, intelligence, and high moral standards. Profits generated by corporations are not evil, but seeking profits at any cost to society is reckless, short-sighted, and immoral. Capitalism without capital is destined for failure. When corporate CEOs, Wall Street bankers, and shady billionaires exercise undue influence over the financial, political, and judicial systems, their short-term quarterly profit mindset and voracious appetite for riches override the best interests of the people and create a sick, warped, repressive society. Today, the American system is in the grasp of psychopaths whose hubris and myopic focus on enriching themselves will ultimately be their downfall. This financial system is sick and is unfortunately, and at an increasing pace, approaching terminal. I think the problem is due to a simple failure or lack of character. It is an old story and a perennial favourite of the madness of the dark powers of the world. Character provides stability and confidence. When character fails, there is uncertainty and fear. You cannot have it both ways. You cannot subject the great part of a people to fear, repression, and enforced deprivation on one hand, and expect them to flourish and consume freely on the other.
Share the truth. Invite others to listen to Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. Richard Martin produces his shows single-handedly, based on his extensive reading and research. Every week, Richard gives you the facts with no spin, for you to make informed decisions on world events that will affect your life. Now, let's get back to today's show.
Okay, and I'm going to talk a little about risk and the dangerous illusion that it can be offloaded onto others. And here I'm referring specifically to confidence in central banks, which raises a pernicious systemic risk. Do you drive carelessly because your auto is equipped with airbags? Perhaps not. But would you drive more cautiously if you were perched on the front bumper? If even the slightest collision would crush the driver's legs to pulp, I think it's fair to say we'd all drive with a higher awareness of risk and with greater caution. The faith that airbags and dashboards protect us in all conditions and times is misplaced. If vehicles were truly safe, how would it be that 32,700 people lose their lives in vehicle accidents every year in the US, and hundreds of thousands of others are injured? The risk, we are assured, is statistically low. Only 21 fatalities per 100,000 licensed drivers. Practically zero, eh? Except that it adds up to 32,700 people killed each year. What statistics do not adequately describe, of course, is that most of those accidents occurred in high-risk settings in which the driver's focus and/or ability was impaired. Even as they reckoned, risk was managed or limited by the equipment, their safe driving record, etc. In other words, the somewhat inebriated gent slips behind the wheel on a dark rainy night, sensing the heightened danger but reassured by such things as the fact he's never been in a fatal accident, by his car's airbags, by the low statistical odds of getting killed, etc. He roars off into the unlit darkness. The odds of an accident under these conditions are much higher than the average listed in statistical abstracts, yet they are glossed over by the apparent low odds of the drive ending badly. This is what you might call the paradox of risk. The more risk is apparently lowered, the higher the risk we are willing to accept. If the drunk wheeled off into the darkness on a bicycle, he probably wouldn't get far. He'd more than likely lose his balance and end up scuffed and sore, but very much alive, in a ditch. The real risks of navigating a dark road while impaired by alcohol are very much exposed on a bicycle. Ironically, the real danger arises when the driver is reassured by safety features and past experiences which appear to limit risk or even make it disappear. This is the situation we find ourselves in today in global financial markets. The central banks are assumed to be the airbags of the system, limiting any losses to a few scratches rather than a complete wipeout. This confidence in central banks raises a pernicious systemic risk. Assuming the 100-year flood can't happen every 6 years or so. There is a book I'd like to recommend called The Misbehavior of Markets by fractal pioneer Benoit Mandelbrot. He explains in simple mathematical ways how modern portfolio theory, i.e. the management of risk, is based on a faulty conception of risk and statistical chance. Briefly, without going into too much complicated detail, while modern portfolio management is statistically based, you know, all those standard deviations, you always see referenced in quantitative analyses. The markets behave what we call fractally. Fractals are known as the geometry of chaos. They describe how seemingly stable systems can quickly and unpredictably degrade into chaos. But as Mandelbrot explains, and I quote, 100-year floods actually occur with startling regularity in all markets. You cannot make all risk disappear with fancy statistical models and credit default swaps, etc., that offload the risk onto others, i.e. counterparties. All you're really doing is masking the risk. You're not eliminating it. And in hiding the real risk, you're lulling the market participants into a pernicious choice architecture in which their willingness to take riskier and riskier actions is rewarded and encouraged, while caution is punished. This is how you get a total systemic collapse of the entire choice architecture. And by this, I mean not just the financial system, but the backstop provided by central banks and counterparties. In a system that is now correlated to central bank policies, the idea that some counterparty will cover your loss is illusory. The entire notion that risk can be offloaded onto others is magical thinking. That when the system implodes, the counterparties will magically escape the highly correlated collapse. This is another paradox of risk. Central bank intervention, financial repression, provides the illusion that systemic risk has been disappeared, and this pushes all asset classes into correlation. The idea that some assets will escape the implosion is also illusory. What appeared uncorrelated can suddenly correlate overnight, destroying the entire fantasy that risk can be offloaded onto others. Well, there have been two points in history when the top 1% controlled nearly 50% of the net worth in the US, 1928 to 1929, and 2007 to 2015. The very top, the 0.1%, control as much as 25% at these peaks. But those peaks don't last, as the bubbles that create such extreme wealth don't last. Their wealth tends to get cut in half in the years and decades to follow. This has devastating consequences to the real estate prices in huge cities where these global elite people park their cash. They see such cities as the safest place to park large amounts of money. Where else can you buy a 4,000 to 9,000 square foot penthouse for $20 to $120 million? They can go for as much as $13,000 a square foot. Try buying a big block of stock for that amount without moving the markets against you. You can't. So real estate in such megacities seems like a great idea. But here's what that assumption might cost them by simply looking back at history. Let's look at how Manhattan, the greatest district in the city of the world, let's look at how it fared in the Roaring Twenties, then the Great Depression. The high end peaked the latest and most dramatically in 1929, then crashed 67% into 1939. That's twice what the average house fell from 2006 to 2012, and more than twice what the Case-Shiller index shows for top cities that went down into 1933. Even the low end went down 58% after peaking in 1927. For comparison, in Washington, D.C., the median house, the true middle market representing the average American, went down only 26% from 1925 to 1933. The Case-Shiller index shows the top cities hit new highs again in 1943, 10 years after its bottom. In D.C., the median house recovered back to its highs by the mid-1940s. But in Manhattan, real estate was still down near its lows in 1939. Sources claim it didn't reach new highs again until 1953. Others claim 1960. You're probably wondering how it could possibly take as much as 30 years to recover. Simple. The greater the bubble, the greater the burst. So we need to ask ourselves, who's buying these properties right now at such outrageous prices? Buyers on the highest end are often foreigners, just looking to get a stake and park or launder money out of their country. More often than not, they don't actually live there. In any major coastal city you go to, the high-end buyers tend to be affluent Chinese, Russians, Brazilians, or Mideasterners. But with the way oil collapsed, hitting the currencies of Russia and the Middle East, and the way commodity collapse has hit Brazil and its currency over 50%, it's now down more to the Chinese. China's government is finally getting serious about cracking down on money leaving the country under the guise of real estate, as I've been telling you would have to happen, the way money's been fleeing out of China at an unprecedented rate. Suddenly, those foreign buyers won't be around anymore, at least not to the extent they have been. Remember the Japanese affluent buying up real estate globally in the late 1980s? They disappeared almost overnight when their real estate bubble collapsed and their wealth with it. And that will leave nothing left to stop this bubble from bursting. Luxury home builder Toll Brothers and top real estate agents are reporting to Bloomberg that they see Manhattan's high end starting to taper off rapidly. One of Toll Brothers' executives, David von Spreckelsen, said, and I quote, "The days of super pricing and of raising prices every other week, I think, are probably past." End of quote. They're switching gears from the larger apartments to smaller units in the $2,000 per square foot range. Imagine that. Zeal Feldman of Manhattan-based HFZ Capital Group says, quote unquote, "I don't want to be a hostage to a 10 to 20 million condo market." As of second quarter, 50% of new development listings were over $5 million. That will not last. When the high end cracks, it will crack in many bubble cities driven by foreign buyers. And when this next real estate bubble bursts, it will happen on a much more global scale, much more severe than the last one. Well, in his 1996 book, Civil War II, The Coming Breakup of America, the American military analyst Thomas Chittum predicted the dissolution of the USA into three parts: White North, Black South, and Spanish-speaking Southwest, with the inevitable concomitant new Civil War. Opponents of this position should not forget that it was the desire for separatism that resulted in the bloody Civil War in the United States in 1861 to 65. In addition, the United States has already granted independence to the dependent territories, Palau, the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, whose population at the time officially announced secessionism? According to opinion polls, over 70% of Americans currently believe that the system of public administration in the US is ineffective. At the same time, about 1 in 5 is willing to support the separatists in his state, speaking for the transformation of the states dissatisfied with Washington, especially the South, into a separate state. Immediately after the re-election of Barack Obama for a second term, the German newspaper Die Welt noted that each of the 50 states of the USA has formed a group of citizens demanding secession of their states from the United States, and I quote, "In their opinion, the state holds them in bondage and they want to go, but without the Civil War. It is no coincidence that Texas is the leader of this list. The Texans are convinced that they feed, clothe, and arm the rest of America." End of quote. Well, being the second largest state of the United States, Texas became an independent state in 1836, the Republic of Texas, after months of the war for independence with Mexico. Did you know this state retained its sovereignty for 9 years? However, in 1845, due to the difficulties in the confrontation with its southern neighbor, against the will of the majority of citizens of the Republic, the Texas authorities asked to be granted the protectorate of Washington, but with an important condition. The Texans have the right to secede from the USA any time. Today, supporters of the independence of Texas, including existing since the 1950s movement, the Republic of Texas, argue that the decision to join the Union was rigged while the state was illegally annexed and therefore is under occupation. The Texan petition for secession from the USA, stating that the U.S. economic problems are the result of the federal government's failure to reform fiscal policies, has already gained more than 100,000 signatures instead of the required 25,000. However, as recently noted by the online news portal Examiner.com, in addition to separation from the United States, Texas has a very clear desire to lead the country, since two of the Texans with the names of George Bush, Jr. and Sr., remain in memory of the people of Texas as the 41st and the 43rd U.S. presidents, while in the upcoming presidential election of 2016, two more Texans are planning to participate: a former Texas Governor Rick Perry and Senator Ted Cruz, who may well have withdrawn by now, but that's the current tally. Therefore, it's possible that if there is a choice, the majority of Texans will not wish to live in the country trapped between the USA, experiencing a number of problems, and disadvantaged Mexico. Moreover, they would prefer to revive the United States with the same style that has made the current Texas economic superpower. In recent weeks, separatist sentiment in Texas has increased significantly, and according to Reuters, it has swept 31 Texan cities, collecting signatures in support of demands for independence. As noted by the news agency, and I quote, "As an independent state, Texas can be a very influential player on the world stage. The volume of its economy amounts to $1.4 trillion a year, which roughly corresponds to South Korea." End of quote. In its confrontation with the U.S. federal government, Texas requests the reserve system, the Federal Reserve System, to return $1 billion in gold bullion belonging to it. In June this year, the Texas governor, Greg Abbott, even signed the bill HB 483, under which, on the territory of Texas, its own storage will be built to accommodate the gold bullion and other precious metals. The Texan own storage for precious metals would be very useful from the point of view of backing the local currency in the event of a break, with the financial support of the US government. However, people of that state do not exclude the possibility of use by the White House, in its characteristic manner, of the army to suppress separatist sentiment in the state, as evidenced by a recent University of Texas Austin opinion poll. Other examples of separatist sentiment in the United States are to be found in states such as California, the richest and largest state of America, the government of which are able to pursue an independent foreign policy and already have an intergovernmental agreement with another state, signed several years ago by Governor A. Schwarzenegger and the former Prime Minister of Great Britain, T. Blair, many of which continues a policy of independence from Washington, and many of the residents of the state believe that they are forced to pay a federal treasury too much. South Carolina has already offered by the mouth of the Republican Senator Lee Bright to issue its own money. The legislators of Virginia, Georgia, Missouri, Idaho, and Minnesota favor similar initiatives. A few states require a permit, the use of gold and silver as settlement tools. Louisiana, with a population of 4.5 million people. Residents of this state have turned to Barack Obama with a request for the proclamation of the independence of their state and the formation of their government. Alaska, which has its own independence party, whose representative Walter Hickel won the election in 1990 and took the governor's chair. Perhaps the only state where separatists have not been particularly active so far is Puerto Rico, which is essentially subsidized by the U.S. budget and has the status of a freely associated state, where the U.S. Constitution is applied only restrictively. Thus, the inner life of the United States is not so simple as it might seem at first glance. Separatism in America is gaining momentum, no less than in the old world, due to a number of reasons. Currently, separatist sentiments do not lie at the heart of extremism in the country, and the authorities manage to restrain the mass protests. However, American separatism is a ticking time bomb, and in case of the collapse of the dollar or other significant political and economic cataclysm in the U.S. federal government, it is possible that the White House might be unable to restrain growing separatism. Ladies and gentlemen, well, that's it. We've come to the end. It's been fun, as always. I've enjoyed talking to you, and this is now Monday, albeit I'm recording this on Friday afternoon my time, so goodness knows what will happen between now, over the weekend, and Monday. You can expect anything and everything. But be that as it may, you will be on Monday, as I hope it is, ready for a new week ahead, and so I hope that it will be a good, successful, and happy one. And I will be back, as always, with another edition of The Wake Up Call on Friday. This is Richard Martin. Until then, take care. Bye-bye for now.
And there you have it. You decide.